now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, and welcome to the show where we interview legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Lee Kerslake is an English musician best known as the longtime drummer and backing vocalist for the rock band Uriah Heep. In addition to his work with Ozzy Osbourne Band. Kerslake joined Uriah Heep in November of 71, left the band in 79, and rejoined them in 1982. In early 2007, it was announced on the Heep website that Kerslake left the band due to ongoing health problems. With Heep, Kerslake also performed backing vocals, both on album and on stage. On the Firefly album, he was credited with the name The Bear, a reference to his beard growth and overall solid physical build. During this time out of Uriah Heep, he worked with Ozzy Osbourne, with whom he recorded Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman, and played with bass guitarist Bob Daisley, who later joined Uriah Heep. On the Diary of a Madman note, Kerslake and Daisley weren't credited. The two musicians were fired in late March 1981, just after the recording session, and replaced for the tour by Tommy Aldridge and Rudy Sarzo. Aldridge's and Sarzo's photos were put on the album, and they were credited as studio musicians, but they didn't play on the album. 1998, Kerslake and Daisley filed suit against Ozzy Osbourne and his manager, Sharon Osbourne, seeking royalties and songwriting credits for their contributions to the Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman albums. Osbourne subsequently erased Kerslake and Daisley's playing on both albums, replacing their performances with tracks by bassist Robert Trujillo and drummer Mike Borden. In 2003, Kerslake and Daisley's lawsuit was dismissed by the United States District Court in L.A. This dismissal was held up by the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Lee now performs with his own band, the Lee Kerslake Band, guests with various bands, and regularly joins ex-Heap members Ken Hensley and Paul Newton in the Uriah Heep Legends. For more information about Lee Kerslake, please visit www.leekerslake.com, and Lee's on Facebook at www.facebook.com/KerslakeLee. Please welcome legendary drummer, songwriter with Uriah Heep and Ozzy Osbourne, The Bear, Lee Kerslake. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Ray. How you doing?
nice
to be on the show.
I'm really mad now at Sharon Osbourne. Every time I see her face, I'm going to think, man, she ripped off Lee, and I'm mad.
it really hurt for quite some time for me and Bob, because with that question, if it wasn't for me and Bob and Randy writing the material for Ozzy and playing, me playing the drums to identify, and Bob playing the bass, Randy's incredible guitar playing, he wouldn't have a career. But that's as it is. That's the way the cookie crumbles. I'm not too in awed by the judgment from the judges in California. I was very, very put back, because I thought, oh, hang on though, wait a minute. If O.J. Simpson can get off with murder, what am I looking for?
Probably any other state would have gone with you on the decision. California,
I think,
just
so, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And
I know.
And I know the story. I know the story about, I think Ozzy asked you, he didn't want to play two shows one night, and you, because of Ozzy, were the one who that went to Sharon and just said, can we just do one show? Because I guess Ozzy's voice was in bad shape or something that night. Is that right? Something like that happened?
He just didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do two shows. He was not used to that, you know, the intensity. Right. And he just asked me to say a few words. So I did. And to that, I was not liked. And that started the rot, so to speak.
Why couldn't Ozzy go to his own wife and tell her?
you know, I'm afraid Ozzy's got that trait in him, Ray.
Yeah.
He's an okay guy. He's all right. He's harmless. He just hasn't got, you know, he hasn't got, I don't even what you call much of a spine.
Right.
You know, he does his job. He does. I mean, let's not knock Sharon in one thing. She's an incredible manager. She got him to catch him up there. After we got him to start with the first two albums, then he blew America apart, which was okay, fine, mm-hmm. you know. But you have to let go, because otherwise, I hated for a long time Sharon and Ozzy. And then I nearly died from cancer and psoriatic arthritis and these other things. I thought, oh, hell with it. You know, let it go. I can't be life's too short. They're going to get their own problems. Let it go that way. I'm not going to, you know, we go and say goodbye. If and I met Sharon now, I'd say hi. You know, it's as simple as that.
Have you talked to Ozzy since then?
Never. No, I never spoke to him again. Basically because I think he was too embarrassed.
Yeah.
I would have asked him why he did it to me, but... I think he was too embarrassed, and I think Sharon kept him shrouded, which is fair enough. You know, mm-hmm. that's one of them things. As I say, it moved on. It was another thing. I mean, I left Ozzy. Mickey phoned me up straight away. So, you know, to reform the Heap, he'd had enough of the Heap of the way it was. It was not working for him in his eyes. And all the members in the band, he was not happy with. So I said, yeah, absolutely. Because to be honest, Ray Heap's as much as my baby as anybody else's. I know it was a year after, but I helped it get to his career the way it was. With Mickey and David and Ken's talents, I did my bit to help it further its the career of America's. Like he did, it was amazing what he did over there. So I felt not responsible. I felt in awe. I did my bit. So I loved Uriah Heep, and we'll always love Uriah Heep. I wish it well. I wish I was able to do an odd show as a reunion, but you never know.
You never know. That's right. Yeah. Well, one of my all time favorite bands always has always been Uriah Heep. And now I've been fortunate to have all three surviving original members on the show. I had Ken and Mick. All great guys. You guys are all awesome, man. I just got to tell you that.
Thank you very much. Very kind of you. Oh, you got Kenny as well, did you?
Yeah, I did Ken. Yeah, we had Ken on the show
cool.
as well.
Oh.
Yeah, another good guy, you know. It's not, I mean, I love, you know, and I covered the show with Mick. I'll be honest with you, and I'm going to be totally honest, it's just not the same, you know? It's not the same. The classic lineup was my favorite. You know, David on lead vocals, that was Heap, in my opinion. And you know, you on the drums, and Ken on the organ, that's Heap, man, you know? And you know, when Gary Thayne, you know, left, and, you know, God rest his soul, and John Wetton came in. That was a great move. I mean, to have John in the van was awesome. So you know.
Yeah, I got him in. I suggested him, and I got him in through my father phoning him up when he was down in Bournemouth. And John, it was wonderful. But he was ambitious and he went his own way. Incredible bass player, God rest his soul. And.
Yeah.
A great singer and great songwriter. So he helped, you know, he lifted his career up by helping lifting ours. So In tit for tat. It was one of those things. We always seem to have trouble keeping musos. You know, I was there from 20 or 30 years nearly.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, unfortunately, my illness took me away out of it. But, I mean, when I think about those days, the early days of when we toured, the first time we toured ever in America was down in Florida on the back end as special guests to Deep Purple.
Right.
That was our thing. And within 3 weeks to 4 weeks, when Mercury, who were our record company, were pumping Easy Living, we took off at such a rate and got such reviews within the 4 weeks. I think it was about 3 months later we were doing our own shows.
Yep.
That's how quick it was. It was amazing.
Those are great times. And, you know, I think, personally, what took you guys into stardom was when you put out the live album. I mean, that was probably the best live album I've ever heard. And it just made me feel like you were on the show. Yeah.
Well, that was the third time lucky, that one.
Yeah.
Did you know? at the third and last time. If you didn't get it down on that one in Birmingham, there wouldn't have been a live album.
Really?
That's the third attempt. Everywhere else, it died. The sound was wrong. The atmosphere was wrong. It just didn't work. Birmingham City Hall, wallop. It made it. So we were all happy with that.
Yeah, my favorite photo, my favorite photo of you was on that live album also.
Oh, me gritting my teeth and doing it.
Yeah. You guys all look cool there. Yeah. You know, I miss David, too. David had such a great voice. You know, for the band.
I loved his voice. I loved his showmanship. And I mean, you think about when we shared a room together in the early stages of Uriah's build up in America. Of course, we had to share rooms for them. The cost was astronomical, you know.
Right.
So we had to share the rooms, and we shared for at least nearly a year on tour. A room together. We had so much respect and so much great fun together. Mm-hmm. Oh, I loved it. I enjoyed it.
Now, were you guys like the typical crazy rock band back in that day, doing some, you know, wild stuff, or were you guys pretty? I know every band I talked to about you guys that kind of toured with you, they all said you guys were so professional, you know, and they learned a lot from you. You know,
we never got towards the latter part when we, you know, there was a slight breakdown because we were having breakdowns because of the work, the amount of work we were doing. But before that, prior to that, we had a discipline. We disciplined all ourselves and said, look, you know, we're from the bottom. We weren't born with a golden spoon in any of our mouths. Mm-hmm. We're from working class people. We worked hard. We've done our apprenticeship. We made to make a band. We've got this magic. Now let's keep it as long as we can. And we, our knowledge, you know, my motto and Mickey's and Ken was, you know, on the way up, you've got to be nice because it takes, you might need some of those people on the way down to break your fall.
The first time I saw you guys was in Baltimore. I think it was 73. And you guys...
Oh, yeah.
You guys headline Earth, Wind, and Fire and ZZ Top first came out. That's when they first came out. Packed house, you know, 14,000 people. And then I saw you later after Gary was gone with John, and you guys played with Blue Oyster Cult after that.
Oh, yeah.
I was lucky to see the original, but, you know, the classic lineups, which, you know, were incredible.
Do you know people don't believe me when I said, we had Earth, Wind, and Fire, and that's us supporting us.
Right.
And we did. They didn't believe. They never believed me. You just proved it to them on the radio.
That's right.
But it was cool. I loved that band. And they were such a class act. That's, again, so professional. And they were in their own right. And I think it was clever. The promoter was clever. He got an entertainment all the way around. So we've got more than one kind of person going to the show. Some people like Earth, Wind, and Fire. Some people like us. That's not a bad thought in those days, you know?
That's right. Exactly.
And, I enjoyed it. Baltimore was a cracker.
Baltimore loved Uriah Heep. Baltimore was well known for Uriah Heep and Jethro Tull. Those two were like gods in Baltimore.
Oh,
Go ahead.
I remember that gig somewhat because we had a load of cream, and we fired the cream on there afterwards at the end. Mm-hmm. And we went over everybody. We hit everybody with the cream, but it was a cream fight in the back in the state, you know, the back area. We were slipping and sliding. You'd thought it was Woodstock 2.
That was a great show. I still have the ticket stub for that.
Great.
I do.
I think getting back to the original way, we appreciated how we got there, because mm-hmm. we worked hard, we had a magic, and the Americans and the Germans and the like, and even the Japanese, they liked what they heard.
Yeah.
And that was brilliant. So we were grateful. We never sat back on our laurels. We just did every interview you wanted us to do, and the manager of that, we did with pleasure. But, I mean, I was going to tell you one story about how naive I was.
Okay.
We're special guesting Deep Purple in the first gigs at the Hollywood Dome thing, the Hollywood mm-hmm. in Miami.
Right.
You know, the gig out in the swamps.
Okay.
We got on the plane at Heathrow. When we got off the plane, my caftan full length and my hat did not work in that weather. I didn't realize that Miami was that hot. And I had a caftan, full caftan on. My God, I was sweating. And it was weird. But it was so cool to see American people react the way they did to us. I thought I knew how they would react to Deep Purple, which they did. But to react to us, John Lord and Ian Paisson, even Ian Ginner would come in and say, you know, come into the dressing room and say, you MFs, you kicked our ass. And, you know, that's great. That's a great thing. It wasn't intentional. We just went on there to really get our music across.
Now, you guys were powerful. Like you said, the word that describes the band was discipline. You know, you guys were right on all the time. Very tight. Very tight band.
Yeah. We always rehearsed.
Yep.
We never took things for granted. We rehearsed at least 2 weeks before we went on the road, if we had the chance. But we always rehearsed. We just had to make sure everything was in tune, everything's tight. You know, it was... You had a lot of responsibility to paying the money to come and see you, you know?
Yeah, I still give you guys a lot of credit for all the touring. You know, that's tough. You know, land a couple hours later, you're playing a gig, then get back on the plane.
Yeah.
And that's tough. You know.
Well, we flew back from America straight mm-hmm. into the studio in Lansdowne Studios in London to do some finishing touches to a backing vocal and harm and guitar parts. And then we were there, and then 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, we went to Heathrow to get a plane to Italy. So, we were a bit busy.
Definitely.
We all got frazzled a bit.
Oh, yeah. You know, after experiencing the live album, I was like a little kid waiting for the Sweet Freedom album to be distributed to record stores. And when Stealin' was played, I was so happy that it was on Top 40 radio, and then they took it off, you know? I guess... people were complaining about the lyrics. I'd done the rancher's daughter, and I sure did hurt his pride, you know?
Yeah,
but,
that's insane.
I was so happy to hear you guys on Top 40 radio. It was like, wow, you know? It was, you know, because it's not your typical Top 40 song, you know? It's Uriah Heep, you know, on Top 40 radio.
Well, did anybody ever try and listen to the words of Leonard Cohen's Walk on the Wild Side?
You know, exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
It that got through no problem.
Yeah.
But we just done the rancher's daughter, you know, whatever. But it gave us more fame. The more that the God Squads tried to put us down, mm-hmm. the more the rebellious the people became, and then it helped us. It didn't do harm. It helped.
No,
us.
It no. But yeah, it did help.
It was, yeah, and it was just so wonderful. In those days, when there was radio shows coming out your ears in America, and you're driving in, and the bus driver would have something on, and you're in Easy Living after the other, one after the other, Easy Living.
Yep.
This show, Easy Living on this one. Easy. I mean, that was amazing to hear that. I never forget that as long as I live.
Yep. You know what I recently noticed? I never noticed it before. When you guys played Don Kirshner's rock concert, I think it was, in 75.
Yeah.
David, when he said, going to put me to an early grave, he says, I'm going there anyway. I never noticed he said
that. Yeah. That was a bit of sarcasm. But it's the way we were working so hard. We all went and looked at each other, nodded our heads. Yeah.
I never noticed that. That's a big thing on YouTube now, because everybody's noticing that, you know?
Yeah.
How difficult was it for when David got fired for you? I asked Mick the same question.
It broke my heart.
Yeah.
It broke my heart because we won, you know, we fought again. It just, let's put it like this. I didn't want it ever to happen, and it did. And it's so sad. But when he got to the point is he was drinking, he couldn't stop drinking before he went on stage. I didn't get what he did afterwards, but he went on stage drunk, and that was... We tried to talk him through it, you know, and it's such a heat, but he was burning out.
Yeah.
And we never saw it. Our manager never saw it. We should have stopped then and pulled the brakes on and said, well, wait a minute. Let's get ourselves, let's discipline ourselves or use our discipline, pull us all back, wait a bit, check it all out, have a break, then come back. But, and, you know, we didn't. And it was one of them things. They went off. When you lose your singer, that's like, you know, if you lose Mick Jagger of the Stones, that's the end of it.
Exactly.
You know, we had a hell of a problem getting another singer. We tried. We got some nutball guy from America, California, called Steph Fontaine.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Steph Fontaine, he dressed like Quiet Riot and the Kiss mixed. And he used to do high kicks, and he wasn't really bothered about his singing. He just wanted to make sure the girls seen do a high kick. He was terrible. How the hell we let him in?
Yeah, David had a very unique voice. They call it operatic, I guess. You know how he hit those notes. You know, but he was a great showman as well.
Well, he was one of the fantastic showmen. Even Rod Stewart went. When we co-headline a gig, you went, how the bloody hell are we going to follow that?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
He was that good. But he also, he cared.
Right.
And in his height of his career, he cared every word. When he sang them on the albums, he identified. He knew exactly what Ken was all about in his words. And that was his magic. Even Ken would tell you that if you interview him again. He loved the music, and he felt for it, and that was one of the main things. We all felt, when we got in the song, we put it, tore it to pieces, put it back together with all our different traits to it, put it down. And that was what the magic was. I mean, I'll tell you this now, it was the same as when I joined Ozzy. I was a missing link with Ozzy, and he asked me to join, and Bob and me and Randy. When we got in the studio, we put it down. Ozzy was never there. And to do the most of the time wasn't there. The magic was what we did. We put that, we recorded, and how we wrote these things. And that's what I try to tell people. It's rare to get that magic, and when you do, someone comes along and blows it out the window.
Exactly. You know, music today is so overproduced and got all the bells and whistles to hide their voices, and you know it's. It's horrible, you know?
Well, yeah, you know, you knew what happened. Of course, we called it the conveyor belt music.
Right.
You get one style of music that comes off say, an English band or an American band, and then everybody wants to copy that, and every record company had to buy up a band that sounded like that, slightly different. And you go, that's not original. There's nothing in that. And that's what used to annoy me. And it has happened today. They buy up and they get on the bandwagon of one style of music. lots of it, lots of chords, lots of bands, lots of everything. And you can, I can honestly say half of the songs, I can't whistle or I can't remember. And I'm a musician.
Yep. It's true. I worry, you know, I mean, rock and roll's been fading for such a long time, but now the Gibson Guitar Company is you know, may go bankrupt. That's like shocking. I know they got other divisions, but they're, you know, the guitar player, like a Mick Bock, is not around anymore. You know, that guy, you know, he's just not around. The guitar hero.
And, you know, they got hammered. We're using a certain wood, apparently. I was told that they used the wood and they got a fine that nearly crucified them.
But, really?
You know, Gibsons were working on the par. They weren't mega bucks, not like they are today.
Right.
And they used a fretboard of a hard wood from somewhere. It was the band. So got a fine. This is what I was told. And then they never called up because then all these Zodiacs, you name it, these guitars came in out of the woodwork. And they were given freebies to star rock and roll guitarists and musicians.
Right, right.
So they never had a chance. Nobody, only the real musos stand the test of time. The old boys that play guitar, and I mean, you know, my age and Mickey's age, even Steve Morse, I mean, his favorite now is your Gibson. Gibson was incredible. He was the top. You know, it was number one. It was phenomenal. And Jeff Beck, Chris Dredger, Jimmy Page, you know, they can't all be wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of a Fender guy myself.
Yeah, but don't take me wrong.
Yep.
Jimi Hendrix.
Yep.
I had the wonderful thing. I played drums with him down at the Club Speakeasy in London with a guy called Joe Konas, who lives in Toronto now, Windsor. And we often look at the photograph. You've just seen my shade and my head in the background. And he was always Fender. But my God, did he make it talk? I mean, sure, you know, come on. I mean, there are guitars out there that are good in their own right. Fender's good. I don't knock it. But it's the sound, that warm sound of a Gibson. It just goes, whoa, you know? You know it, identify anywhere.
Lee, I want to talk about The Sun Has Gone Hazy. You know, I gave it 5 stars, man. It, you know,
wow,
it's a great album. And we have a mutual friend, you know, Tuija. I think that's how, Tuija?
Tuija.
Tuija, you're right.
Tuija.
I had lunch with her and Corky Lang here in Florida. We had lunch together.
Yeah, because they were doing their show?
The rock opera. He was doing the rock opera. We were talking about that. But I guess she introduced you. I think it was Maddie and her, and they introduced you to Stefan, right?
Yeah. We kind of knew Stefan in a way in early stages, but I never really took much notice. And then we went and did it, a couple of gigs with, we formed a band called It's Master's Project when my boy was on it. And that was rather good. But then we got together at their birthday, Tuija's birthday. I think it was her 40th. I'm not sure. But I was there anyway. And I started writing. And then Stefan said, I've got these ideas. And I said, yeah, okay. And I started singing to his guitars. Before we knew it, and about 4 bottles of Chardonnay white wine between us, we started writing like 6 songs. And that was the start of The Sun Has Gone Hazy.
Oh, it's a great album.
Okay, we were very, you know, we did the drum tracks in a studio. It's called The Garage, and it's just outside of of Stockholm, and we just did the backing tracks for the bass and drums there, and we did all the rest in the bedroom of Stefan's house.
Really?
And,
huh.
Yeah, but I was so chuffed with it, because, you know, the words, the meanings, the way we work together, we really hit it off. We really.
You mesh very well together, you know. And Stefan's got a great voice.
I was praying and hoping to get a release from the record company in America, but you know what it is. And
I know.
And to me, it's such a shame because it's such a worthy album. But there you go. We'll keep on trying.
Did you pronounce Stefan's last name? Is it Berggren?
Berggren, yeah.
Berggren, right. He's from Sweden. He's a singer and producer. He's a guitarist and keyboard player. Born in Stockholm. Yep. You know what I said about the album? You know, I gave it 5 stars, and you can quote me on this. I said, rock is alive and well as long as Stefan and Lee are still around.
Well, that's so cool, though. That's what I appreciate it, because what we've done, we've mixed it with commercials. We did a commercial single, a couple that are long and extended. You know, it's all my identity. It's all my things that I used to do in your Heap.
Yep.
So it's carried with me, and I put it into another person, which is Stefan, and I brought out his styles, which he'd never done before. He used to just do blues. And between us, we brought each other out and this music. And when we finished, we went, this is bloody great. It really is good, you know? And the one that I liked Walk Tall. I thought was a great track.
It's a great track. Great guitar work. Yeah, great guitar work.
Yeah.
Fantastic drums. It sounds a little bit of a country rocker in a way. You can take it that way.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's what I want. Yeah, because that's the way we've led it. Because then you've got My.
Right.
Do you understand? Well, that was based around what my mother and father, my mum was a wonderful person. Mm-hmm. She was a sweetheart. And if she used to get angry and lose her cool, she used to call my father. She'd say to him, Eric, now My. And that was like,
I liked it.
Call it, you're getting me pissed off. That was her way.
That's a very passive way of getting mad.
I
like that.
And I wrote the song about my. I'm remembering my mom.
Supersonic Dream, your intro into that, very Uriah Heep sounding. I heard Uriah Heep in that tune. The Sun Has Gone Hazy, another fantastic tune, great lyrics on that one. You know, it's just a great album. Everybody should need to go out and buy that. I think it was released two years back, right?
Well, you're right. I mean, I thank you very much. I'm glad you like it. Give it 5.
I love it.
Because I'd love to get a release, and my manager, Steve Weltman, is working on it.
Right.
To get in touch with record company in America, because I think it needs individual, it needs to maybe have the cover changed, the title changed, you know, because the Americans, you know, they don't have the same sense of humor as we do, so they might see a different way of looking at it. They might advise us a better way, but I'd love them to take it on. It'd be brilliant, because I hate time is being wasted, and we did so much work to that song, that album, and I'm so proud of it. And it got, like you gave it 5, we had from Canada, we got rated in 10 different record companies, not record companies, radio shows are still existing in Canada. Mm-hmm. And it got 4s and 5s. And even Japan, they talked to me about how they liked it. But nothing push, because the record company was in Germany.
Yeah.
And they did their bit, and then that was it. So it's a shame, but we keep pushing it.
Yeah,
you
America's changed so much when it comes to music. It's such a shame, because that used to be, you know, we used to know everything about rock. You know, we had a lot of aficionados everywhere. You know, we had underground radio. You know, we had awesome things. And now the other countries are the ones that have kind of taken over, and they know their stuff, because they still embrace it. You know, like Amsterdam, you know, like you said, Japan. you know, parts of Europe, you know, and that's where a lot of bands get famous is overseas, and they stay there.
That's true.
You know?
But remember now that there's Universal and Sony, they're buying up all the other record companies in England and Europe,
really,
as many as they can, because they want to turn it back to CD and to vinyl, because they're sick and tired of people throwing up saying, I don't like download because it's there. There's no character. And I agree. I couldn't agree more. And it would give a chance to the kids, you know, bands today that are struggling, like a band called Propaganda, who I believe in, my manager's got, they're genius. They're fabulous. But they can't get anywhere because of the way it's download and or nothing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they don't get a penny, so they have to keep their jobs. They can't rehearse. They can't do this, they can't do that. And I think that's such a shame. And I'm glad now that some record companies are getting the back. Hopefully, America will say, come on, let's get the radio shows back again. You know, Fox 109, KT 104, whatever it was. You know, all the great days were, everywhere you drove on a bus, you'd listen and you'd hear so many different styles of music. And you'd love it, you know. I remember More Than a Feeling. Remember the Boston, the band Boston?
Sure.
I remember the first time I heard that. I was driving. I was sat in the front with the bus driver, Billy Bob. And this song came off, and I went, bloody hell, that's a monster. You know, and it was. But it got played.
Yeah.
You know, it was played back to back. And that's what's missing. As soon as it's put on YouTube or whatever,
right,
they download it, they play it for a bit, and then they throw it. That's it. No.
Well, you know,
now
I used to be... Yeah, go ahead.
I think they're starting to... The kids today have got an interest. I think they want to know who the band are, what they look like, a bit of their past. And I think now the CD and the vinyl, with all the credits and everything information, is going to come back. I'm hoping. Even if it's after I've gone, I'll be happy because... It has to happen. The kids today, they want to see it. Mm-hmm. They'll go to a rock show just on the name only, but now they could also have all the information on that band instead of just not knowing what's going on.
I've got a book I'm trying to get published. It's finished. It's called Radio Killed the Rock Star. Because, you know, radio made the rock star, but then it killed it, you know, because they stopped playing all their new stuff. They don't have an avenue to play anything new anymore, you know. And you know, I talked to Dave Mason one time, and I said, "Well, you got a new album come out?" He says, "What for?" He says, "No one's going to buy it." He says, "I don't have a place to advertise it anymore. The radio's not going to play it anymore." You know, it's sad.
Yeah.
You know, it's sad when you hear stuff like that.
Yep. It is sad because that's the one thing, as I said, their kids are now getting inquisitive. YouTube and all those rich, the multi-billionaires of those people, companies on the computer, they get it. They charge because they get commission off their advertising. So they make their money.
Right.
But when they take the download, it's free.
Yes.
They don't care about us, so we don't get a penny. And yet, you know, I was watching something on a band, like there's 1.3 million bytes or likes on it. They were lucky if they get it. $1,000.
Yep.
That's terrible. But,
yeah.
but the you know the computer, the channel that it's on, they make 100,000, 150,000. Wrong. I know it's going to change. It's got to change.
I hope so. You know, I miss those days where you went to the record store and I miss the album cover and the
pictures.
That's
right. You've hit it. You know? You've hit the nail on the head. The album cover, whether it be CD or vinyl. Vinyl is a lot warmer than CD, agreed. But they still, both sides of it, have the information you can read up, and you got all the credits. That's why I've done mine. I've done a mini album called 11-teen now, and I worked on it through my chemo last year. And I had to stop because my psoriatic arthritis got so bad I couldn't get out of bed and really struggling. But now I'm fighting it on the wing. I'm taking all these alternative medicines from the great Navajo tribe and Shoshone tribes. And I think it's winning. But what it is, it's an album called 11-teen.
Okay.
And the reason I called it 11-teen, because when I was a kid,
right,
I used to go, why isn't 11-teen in our numbers? You know, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 11-teen, 20. So I've called the album something I thought of when I was a kid, 11-teen. And it's me in my hat. I'd love to send you a cover. Once I get it done, we get it sorted out, we get a release date, I'll send you one.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I'll get you back on the radio again. Yep.
Great. Because it'll be me and my dog and my old 1955 Harley Davidson cap.
Awesome.
Someone found for me and bought me as my birthday present. And I got it was me on the front with my dog under my arm. He's passed away now, but I had a great time doing it. And I just want people to realize, you know, this is, again, a different style. Again, they're totally different. It's a bit of country in it. I really wanted to do it. I've tried to do it. I hope I've achieved it. Forgive me if I haven't to the public, the punters, but I'm sure they'll like it.
Now, when is it going to be released? When you want to release that?
Well, we're still fighting. My manager, Steve Welvin, is still fighting for it now to try and get it as a mini CD. But, I mean, as he keeps on arguing and fighting, I'm writing more. I'm going in on the 9th of March with my friend Jake Lavaretto, and we're going to do another two. So I'll have six down by then. So, maybe, you know, it'll be a three-quarter album.
I'm looking forward to that, definitely.
I'm very chuffed with it because it's got my feelings, my character in it, just solo. So just save for one, the rest are mine. You know? And let's see, there's hope.
Didn't you also mention a documentary or something about Heap that you were gonna be involved in?
Well yeah, this film company are doing a documentary on me as we speak. I was up at a radio show that does just vinyl, BBC 4. Radio in Chelmsford, and this TV company, they are so into me, apparently. They are absolutely amazed that I've survived. Well, I've survived because I had cancer, prostate cancer, and I have PSA 2025. Mm-hmm. And severely dangerous emergency is between 100 and 150. Now I had 2025.
Right.
And so I was in a long time getting cleared up. But I got through it. Then I got arthritis, psoriatic arthritis. And then I got a heart murmur. And then I got diabetes. So I've got a few going.
Right.
And one more and I get the Guinness. I'll get this one. One more and I get the Guinness Book of Records.
Lee, you sound wonderful, man. And you look great, too. So whatever you're doing, keep it up.
I'm eating the aloe vera, fresh aloe vera leaves. That's part of the Indian, and they advise you to do all that. And I believe in it. I don't believe in the tablets invented by drug people. I think they just had to make money. I think these people, the Indians and so forth, they mean it. You know, so I'm taking all the alternative medicines. I think it's working gradually, and I hope so, because I want to be around a bit longer yet. I got a few things to prove that I'm still doing it. I've got through it, and the new album 11-teen. People might hear it and enjoy it in America. And then I'll come over and do some shows.
Yeah, we'd love to see that.
I'd love to come over.
Here's a question, Lee, that I ask everybody, and I get some interesting answers.
Go.
If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie Field of Dreams, to play, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
To play and collaborate? Oh, I could say that without a question. Randy Rhoads. David Byron.
And David again.
And Gary Thayne. Randy Rhoads, David Byron, Gary Thayne, me, And, I mean, obviously, with the keyboards of Ken Hensley, he's got such a feel. But then, there are, Don Airey is my number one keyboard player at the moment, having worked with him a few times. The guy's a genius. But those are David, Randy, and I really do think Gary Thayne. I think because there's so much quality in them. But not, let's not forget, remember Trevor Boulder, bless him. He was a talented player.
But it's
that Field of Dreams. It's a rather an expanse for me. It's more like a city of dreams. I mean, I have so many that I could say, come back, please. All of just a little bit longer. But life's short, and then you die.
It is. Yeah. Exactly. You're exactly right. Do you remember when Gary Thayne got electrocuted on stage? That must have been horrific.
Dallas, that in night. Texas, I think.
Was
I think
it was.
Texas?
Yeah.
And he was just about to do the stealing, and I saw the flash. It threw him right across. And because in those days, you had a lot of the places weren't earthed properly. You know, they were not earthed. And he just clobbered him. The massive blue flash like lightning from the microphone, six inches to his lip, threw him, I'd say, about 3 foot in the air to about 8-9 foot back.
Wow.
And that really affected him, I think. But that would affect anybody, wouldn't it?
Oh, definitely. What happened? I heard something that he was kind of sweating. Did that have anything to do with it? That the wetness or anything like that, or?
Well, no one can really say other than the fact that it was so static and there was no earth. He was playing the guitar, went to go out and sing about 3-4 inches from, and you know what? A conductor can hit him, go travel through his guitar, and voila, he's a conductor. And that's all I remember just seeing. He wasn't particularly a sweaty person, you know. He was really dead cool with it. He didn't really sweat a lot. So I don't think it was sweat. I just think he just got the known non-earth or in either in our equipment or in the establishment. I'm not so sure. I can't remember, you know, I don't know. But I just remember seeing the blue flash and then being thrown across. And then that was it. He was out. And I mean, if that had been me, Jesus.
Yeah.
I'd have been a wreck. I'd have been playing the drums twice as fast.
I talked to Jim McCarty, you know, from Yardbirds, about Keith Ralph. About his, when he got electrocuted. It was terrible because he was all alone when it happened.
Yeah.
And he just plugged in.
We were lucky to.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were lucky to be there on stage, but lucky our road crew knew, you know, saw what happened, a couple of them.
Exactly.
They got medics in so quickly. I think they must have been outside or something because of their on hand. They were there within a heartbeat. So, and he was taken in and he got through it. But I think it scarred him. I think then that was a turning point for him in the end.
Yeah,
you know, I think, you know, I that's a hell of a thing to get, you know, a massive shock like that.
You know, I wanted to talk just real quick about the Gods, which was basically a super group that was founded in 1965. Man, you had that band had at one time Mick Taylor, Brian Glasscock from Tall, Ken was in there.
They had been in there.
When
I joined, Mick Taylor just left to join the blues. I can't remember the name of the blues band now.
John Mayall.
John Mayall. He went to join John Mayall.
Right.
And then Ken went down with Paul Newton. His father was a manager. And then they saw me. He saw me playing in the Pavilion in Bournemouth, and decided, said, you know, do you want a gig? We come, he came round to my house late that night, said, I saw you playing, do you want a gig? Then I said, yeah, okay. So I signed up and went along. And then we got, who did we get then? We got Greg Lake.
Greg Lake, yeah.
And Ken Hensley.
Mm-hmm.
Me. No, hang on. Joe Coness, Ken Hensley, me, and who else? Who was on the bass? Oh, Paul Newton. Paul Newton
okay.
was on bass then.
Paul Newton, right.
And then we were living in a place called Andover. And in Andover, it was a village. There wasn't much of an opportunity for us to go anywhere. So we made up our mind, we told the manager, we're moving, we're going to London. So we've got to go to London to try and make it big. And we moved to London. Paul Newton and his father, we fell out, had arguments. He left, Paul Newton, his father left. So we carried the band on with ourselves, and we got Greg Lake in. So Greg Lake was a great singer, bass mm-hmm. player, and mm-hmm. we suddenly became a cult band.
Yep.
And we did the Marquee, Three Nights on the Trot, sold out. And we were suddenly a good cult. But we were all singers. You know, Joe Coness, Ken, me, Greg Lake, we were all singers. Yeah, with Ken Hensley in there. So you had a four-piece band, singing harmonies, and that's where Uriah Heep was, the origination of Uriah Heep. Because one of our favourite ones was Keep Me Ken Hanging On by the Turtles. Is it Keep Me Hanging On? Send me free, word on your bank. That one.
Yeah.
And we did that for years on the road.
Huh.
And that's how the Uriah Heep started. Because me, Ken and Greg and Joe, and their harmonies were so good, all very high and such like. Of course, Ken left and then eventually joined the Heap, and I joined later, and I became in with Ken and David singing the mid-range harmonies, and that's how it took off.
One of my favorite tunes was Long Time, Bad Time, Sad Time. Remember that one?
Oh, blimey. Daily. You got me now. My baby was July Morning.
Okay.
I just loved to play that one. That was my baby. I loved it. Never got bored, never got fed up with it. And then Ken used to say that.
What's cool is the Gods are on YouTube, and you got a lot of good music on YouTube from the Gods, and the quality is excellent.
Yeah.
I don't know who put it on there, but it's excellent. Yeah.
On the towards the skies. I was told the other day, switch on to YouTube, there's one of your songs on.
Yeah.
I went, oh, blimey. Yeah.
You had blonde hair back then, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I had fair hair when I was younger.
Right.
I had fair hair. Because I used to live down, when I lived in Bournemouth, because I was always out on the boats. I was a mad man for fishing, and I always liked to be in the sea, swimming. I loved the water. I was like a marine boy. And so my hair used to bleach all the time. But then it stayed blonde. But then I looked through it, and then it looked really bizarre. Then it started to darken again. And I went, no, I'll keep it blonde. So I kept it blonde.
Well, Lee, if you hadn't become a musician, what do you think you'd be doing right now?
I don't really know. I guess I was working hard at being an electronics engineer for science research.
Right.
But in those days, I was picking up $1.50 a week to $2 a week. I was picking up, I think it was. And I was picking up about $25 in music. So I kind of, there was no brainer really, that's, and I was picking up the girls as well. That's what swayed me.
Do you have any good road stories from the Uri Heep days? Anything crazy?
No, not really. There are so many that I can't bring to bear at the moment.
Yeah.
Because there were so many, but I can't remember them. I'm sure that Mickey gave you a few, or Ken might have done, but offhand, no. It's a blank. That's the trouble psoriatic arthritis. Huh?
You guys were so disciplined anyway, so you were thinking about music.
We still used to get on the bus. We used to get on the bus and party on the bus, so we didn't get in any trouble.
Lee, anything else you like to add?
Our own karaoke.
Anything else you like to add?
Not really. I mean, I've just had a wonderful... It's been great talking to you, Ray.
Great
and I've enjoyed it immensely. And I hope that, as I said, one day, keep a lookout for The Sun Has Gone Hazy. It may have changed title, but we will do, if we can get a release date, because I think people need to see it and hear it, everything, because there's also a DVD out with it. So, you know, then when we played in Stockholm in one of the major clubs there, and it was really cool. It was really a good gig. So, we'll see. Well, Let's keep our fingers crossed.
We love to see you out again, especially if you're with Ken and Mick again. Just a little reunion there would be nice.
Absolutely.
I don't care where you're playing. I'll be there.
Okay, buddy. Don't forget 11-teen.
Let me know on Facebook when it's about ready to come out, and then we'll go ahead and promote that as well, okay?
Oh, bless you. Bless you. That's
Lee,
cool.
Thank you so much, man, for being on the show, for all the incredible music. You know, keep me posted on Facebook, and we love you, man.
Oh, bless your heart. God bless. Give my love to all of America, all those kids out there. I'll see you when I can.
Okay, Lee. Thank you so much, man.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye now. Be sure to purchase Lee's most recent release, The Sun Has Gone Hazy, by the Bergen Kerslake Band at Amazon.com. For more information about Lee Kerslake, visit www.leekerslake.com/ or at Facebook at www.facebook.com/KerslakeLee. Very special thanks to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me biweekly at our new time and date, biweekly Wednesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com, and I promise you will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.